Gentlemen, you are both drunk on cosmic wine.
Welcome to the show. I'm Dr. Mark Sylvester.
And I'm Dr. Richard Schulman.
This is All Psych.
We are currently ripping. That's how it works. I just click the button and it works, man.
Beautiful.
Welcome to the show. Got a very special guest, colleague, friend, kindred spirit, better hair, better shirt, worse wall art, Dr. Sean Paul. Welcome to the show. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for filling in for our co-host for Dr. Schulman, who's out in health reasons.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me, man.
Thrilled to have a lot of people don't know you're a psychiatrist here in town. You specialize, you're boarded in not only adults and what I do, but you see kids, which I think right there makes you a special breed of saint. But we trained together, right? I was trying to remember, maybe I'm a year ahead of you or something like that.
A couple, yeah. One year. Yeah, University of Florida. I think trained is good, you know.
So great place. You stuck out like a sore thumb at UF. And I love that because I felt like a sore thumb. And the things that you would say and the way that you would approach information resonated with me because I don't think you were older when you went to medical school, but I remember thinking, wow, this guy really gets it. I hope this program doesn't stamp that out of him. Because I was worried about that for myself, but we had a lot of great talks over the years. And we're going to have a really awesome one today on really chemicals, consciousness, and creativity. Why? Because I like alliteration and I'm ripping that title off from somewhere else on the internet, which won't be hard to find probably.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, I mean, I would make one comment on our education. You know, as physicians and doctors, we come from a very formalized model, right? And I joined UF coming out of New York from more of a psychoanalytic model. I think that informs the way you do things too, is we are, you know, we're therapists too. And we have a psychological backbone to what we do. Medicine is a part of it. And, you know, I think that's something we share together is this institution of medicine, Western medicine, is it serving us the best? And so I definitely thank you for the compliment. And, you know, we share that.
Well, I got more compliments. I got more smoke. I got to blow up your skirt. Because one thing I hear about you, and I got years, I'm in the community, I know people, is a very rare thing. And it's something people say about me. And it's just sad when I say it out loud. But it's really important if you think about it. And the compliment is that you treat people like humans. Now, it's sad for our profession, but that's a compliment for you and I, because I don't really hear that very often. Yeah. A lot of people are taken aback.
I hear it. I hear it about you too, man. And, you know, I think it's a quality of, you know, approaching what we do, especially in psychiatry, but especially in medicine, you know, as a human to human, person to person experience. You know, what people are going through, especially right now, is tough. You know, and I feel it, and I know you feel it, and we share it as people, you know, not as the doctor or the figure of authority. It's we're people, we're feeling it. And I think it's an important part of what we do to tune into that.
Well, so today we're going to be just a couple of Joes. We're going to be a couple of schmoes here, and we're operating from our middle-aged white male, a privileged perspective and in a time and a culture that hopefully is obvious. But we're going to, you know, use what we've learned throughout our lives and experiences to put a lens on probably one of the oldest questions of mankind. And that's, who are we? How do we come to being? And why are we here? Kind of things. These really deep existential things. And certainly religions, spirituality, life lessons, there's a tremendous amount of things that shapes and evolves us intellectually or spiritually or existentially, psychologically. But we're going to kind of focus on the chemistry and how it's transmuting the transceiver that we call our brain. The Greeks, you know, taught, and really, it's a Greek word, psychedelic. Psyche, of course, meaning mind, and delic meaning manifesting. So I think what they mean by the mind isn't necessarily the brain, right? The brain's the hardware and the mind is the software. The problem is we don't know where that software lives. So there's still this debate about, you know, is consciousness create, is it an epiphenomenon of the certainly complex, probably the most complex thing that we know of, which is our brain, which I think people really underappreciate. But cultures have known this forever across, across, you know, eons since the beginning of humanity. But long before that, these substances existed on our Earth, whether they're from our Earth originally or not, it's another debate, that interact with biology, whether that's animals, plants, funguses themselves, and mycelial networks, some of the things we've talked about on the show before. But I'm kind of curious and fascinated and wanted to talk about how they came to affect humans, whether that's a remnant of our evolution, whether they were placed there by some divine supreme being, whether it's kind of a recycling because some of these molecules are very, very organized, very complex, very specific, kind of that lock and key you were talking about. Why did we become sentient, and why do these things affect sentience and consciousness in the first place, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, why does, you
start
know,
off
why
with
does...
the light. That was an easy one. That was a powder puff there, starting off with the light.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does it all mean, Basil?
Go right at the light stuff, man. I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, it. Why does DNA organize itself in the ways it does? Why do chemical bonds organize themselves in the way they do? You know, it's there's a mysterious, mystical quality to, you know, consciousness. And like you said, we don't really know how these things work. We don't really know how these chemicals affect the brain. The complexity is so large that, you know, I tell a lot of people I work with, we don't really understand how this, you know, taking a regular normal psychiatric drug like Prozac, what it really does. I mean, we know the receptor it works on and that it pumps up your serotonin, makes you feel good, you know, found that out by mistake. But, you know, I think there's an organization to it. And I think there's a conception that I've come to philosophically outside of a scientific perspective that there's a purpose. There's got to be a purpose. There's got to be a reason that we've manifested like this, you know, our own minds, our own consciousness, as we're calling it. So I think talking about that is sort of critical. We were talking about that earlier too.
Yeah, I don't like the word. I'm not a big fan of the word psychedelic because one, there's a little bit of pejorativeness of the word mind itself. Manifesting, absolutely, I think, is less open to confusion. But a lot of people would call them entheogens, God revealing. So there's this sense of existence, of purpose, of a supreme being, of something clearly so far above and beyond any memory of a parallel experience that it truly not only is ineffable, but it creates this profound psychic shift, similar to what we talked about with near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, shared death experiences. Mm-hmm. Ecstatic experiences, et cetera, transcendental things. But it's kind of, this one is pushed by biology. This isn't falling in love, although some people would argue falling in love is just a purely chemical reaction. This isn't an artifact of our existence that kind of came out of nowhere. This is a chemical alteration. And most of the time, intentional, right? If it's being used by shamans, it's used for transcendence. If it's there's that, or shamanism and guided imagery, there's always an intent there, I think, in the current use.
No, absolutely. But recall, I mean, and you know this well, Mark, there's people having mystical experiences and been having them since the dawn of man, without using these substances. So there's something endogenous inside of our brains that, you know, dimethyltryptamine is a good example too of.
That's why I didn't tell you about that before the show. That's my that's my coup de grace. That's how we're closing this baby.
That's how we're closing the baby. Well, let's get right to it. I mean,
sorry, we'll just edit this out.
Sure. these receptors are endogenous to a degree. So, you know, even just looking at it from a lens of what we're diagnosing, which I don't probably think we have time to go into what the heck the DSM is and why it exists, but at least what we're explaining, you know, is it, gosh, I don't know where I was going with this, but, you know, essentially these names that we're giving mental health diagnoses, you know, a lot of, there are people who strongly believe that there are, what we're calling bipolar, for example, or mania, or, you know, a psychotic break or whatever, are more of, you know, a spiritual emergency or an emergence of you know, locked in energy, psychic energy that just needs to be released, needs to get out, needs to be worked through. We know through doing therapy, that's absolutely true. Where is the line? It's extremely blurry. Saying as a psychiatrist, this is definitively this, a lot of times I can't do it. But certainly creates some confusion around what's happening with some of these substances and what they can unlock.
Well, let's go through a couple because I got a good one to start with right here. And you see this little guy, this pop quiz. And you know why? This is your fault, because you're actually academically studying this. You're in a fellowship learning all about this, which is awesome in and of itself. But pop quiz, what are we looking at here?
I believe that's, I'm not 100% sure. Is that Flyagaric?
It is. So this is the famous mushroom species, Amanita muscaria, contains a psychoactive compound called muscimol that was famous in Alice in Wonderland. So this is where we're going to start down the rabbit hole. This is a very interesting mushroom. It's ancient. It's been used by ancient cultures. It's been certainly idolized in that regard and used in the sacrament. It tends to be one of the colder weather mushrooms. It grows in the Pacific Northwest. It does grow in high altitudes. There's actually some evidence Vikings experimented with this, which we'll come back to, since it obviously didn't mind reveal God to them, those godless Jezebels. But there have been other cultures,
yeah.
Like, let's see if I know how to do this. I guess the answer is no. There's been other cultures, whether they're Native American cultures, Mazatecs, Aztecs, Mayans, pre-Columbian for sure, that have a lot of experience with the psilocybe. And no surprise,
dating back to, you know, 3,500 years, there's evidence of that. You know,
yeah, I mean,
artifacts through cave, through, you know, through artifacts, I think mostly sculpture.
So let me see.
Organize a large part of how they perceive themselves in the world.
Definitely, and it's been important in their religious, their connection with nature, their connection with gods, their understanding of their role in the universe, the afterlife, all of that. I'm trying to pull up a nice little picture right now. This is why we need more likes and subscribes, so I can get someone to do this for me. But they've dug up ancient sculptures. They were a little nutty with it. They definitely saw this almost as a deity in and of itself, which Correct. Is profound for the time that these people were using them and the reasons that they were using them. It's really quite remarkable.
Well, their word for it in Mayan was the flesh of the god, right? Which is fascinating because, you know, many thousands of years later, that's the sacrament, the holy sacrament. My faith, my background is a Christian, as a lot of people in this country are. I mean, that's, you know, this is my body, right? This is my flesh. and it was condemned by the Spaniards, by the conquerors, the beautiful picture, as, you know, paganism. But ironically, it doesn't have to do with the actual literal meaning of this, right? They're not cannibals. We're not cannibals.
So this kind of shows the various mushroom stones going back at least 1,000 years. I would argue more like 5,000 psilocybe, but these are some of the more recent statues and figurines. Well, if you didn't, let's see. Well, you nailed the fly agaric, but this is a real fascinating one. This plant was used actually as a sacrament in central Mexico. But it did not exist in the United States until 1957, which is very odd that the exact moment it was introduced was known. But in this case, it was. It was brought back by Gordon and Wasson, a couple of researchers who were studying this plant and its psychoactive properties. Interesting side note about this plant. I actually researched this plant when I was in medical school in Miami with a woman by the name of Deborah Mash. And there was kind of a race to determine why it was psychoactive. In other words, we didn't even know what the psychoactive ingredient was in this plant until the 2000s. And we were about 6 weeks from publishing when another group unfortunately beat us to it and nicknamed the psychoactive compound Salvinorin A. It's not terribly original, but really interesting plant. You know, I think this, what I was saying, I don't like the word psychedelic, is because there is a lot of mind revealing aspects to these. There's a lot of physiologic responses, whether that's nausea, vomiting, sedation, right, euphoria. There's a lot of existential parts of this. Yeah. And then there's a lot of hallucinogenic, right?
Absolutely. So this is the Salvia divinorum.
Yeah, or diviner sage is what that means. It's a member of the mint family. You can go to Home Depot, Lowe's, and find it's a very, very close chemical cousin. Here it has it little pretty red flowers. Mm-hmm. Very kind of interesting. It's got I took this picture because it's got a square stalk, which other than the salvia, I don't know anything else in nature that has a square stalk. It's very cuboid looking. It's kind of puzzling. Unique in that regard. Of course, out west, right, we've got the pre-Columbian, again, thousands of years old, that had discovered this little baby, this little cactus. Not the best picture, but when you're stealing them and having to credit them, this was a good one because it shows a little bit the molecule and then the cactus that that mescaline naturally occurs in.
Yeah, just a central part of the sacrament of the Native American church, you know, protected under federal law, a fascinating backstory on how that all panned out and how it continues to be controlled by the federal government. Someone else's sacrament, someone else's divine plant, someone else's a fundamental part of how they identify themselves on this planet, in this world, spiritually with their community, continues to be controlled by the government.
Heavily, heavily controlled, but there is some regulated use within churches like Native American Church and Ayahuasca or the peyote sacraments. So there are some special exclusions for this.
Oh yeah, no, the exclusion is completely for the Native American Church, but I was, my comment was, the rights of humans to have their own plants, right? I mean, it's a modern irony, or maybe disaster of of respecting someone else's culture and right to responsibly use plant medicine, right? But no, certainly the reason I bring that up, because you mentioned stealing pictures, a lot of people are going onto native lands or open lands and harvesting peyote legally, and it's an endangered species. Climate change is definitely threatening it.
Yeah, and a couple of those things. A lot of times we use these, like you said, they're mimicking endogenous machinery, whether that's they're mimicking a neurotransmitter or they're disrupting. Like I couldn't agree more with, we don't really have the slightest clue how Prozac works. We can tell you where it binds. And then we can give you this sort of anecdotal outcome. It'll make you feel happy. They lose me right there because I don't think we have the snowballs, a chance in hell in our lifetime of truly understanding the perturbation that a chemical makes and how it affects trillions of cells, right? I mean, I can throw a rock in a lake and see it make a little bloop and a couple waves, but I'm not going to sit out there forever and watch those waves go across the Pacific and how they interact with other waves. And essentially something like that is going on in our brain. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean introducing the chemical didn't help. It just means don't pretend like you know why it helped when you don't even really know the system that you're operating with.
Humbleness, right? And I try to, you know, I think if, you know, the more you lock it down using words, like the farther you get from the reality of it, you know, when you're talking about, particularly when you're talking about, you know, mind manifesting or entheogenic plants, there's a part of it, you know, that parallels that you just have to accept as words come close. Huxley comes close in talking to, you know, he was probably the closest I've read, you know, yeah.
Well, and so there's this ineffability piece, but then there's also, I think the reason why Western medicine or science in general hasn't really been able to test some of this is a lot of these are either untestable hypotheses with our current understanding, or we just can't put together a reductionistic model of something that by nature is so complex. Mm-hmm. We're just sort of chimpanzees trying to do calculus here.
Yeah,
that's not how nature.
Absolutely. I mean, there's certain things, you know, in terms of how antibiotics work, like you were talking before, where you have a reduction in fever, you have a return of white blood cell count to normal. You physically see someone get better, they start getting out there eating, they're feeling better. Psychological health, we don't have that parallel. So I think it didn't fit in the model of hypothesis. Here's this many milligrams of this substance, right? At all. And that's not the role it came up through, you know, shared experience over thousands of years, you know?
Well, we're certainly not going to go down this rabbit hole, but I would make one comment. One of my favorite movies, Contact. And then it had Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey, and I guess
great it's movie.
Dating a little bit, but there's kind of this science versus religion parallel, I guess they got going on mm-hmm. in that movie, which is one problem, but let's just ignore that. And, you know, Jodie's very scientist based and well, you know, if there's a God, prove it and that kind of thing. And of course, Matthew McConaughey is the quasi believable preacher that challenges her with, you know, did you love your father, your late father? And she said, yeah. And he said, prove it, you know? And it just showed this chasm between something that people inherently know and your ability to prove it. So I think the same type of thing's going on. There was a cruel trick in evolution. We became self-aware. Like Stephen Hawking said, we learned how to speak. We learned how to think. We learned how to say, what's that smell and where is it coming from? And that's kind of a blessing and a curse, really, because we're ill-equipped to really analyze ourselves at this stage of evolution. And I think that's a part of why we're struggling right now. But arguably, you and I would agree, you're here, I'm here with you, this reality, this moment in time and space, you and I agree, we're here. I'm you, you're me, we're on planet Earth that dates this, that. It's what I call consensus reality. If I took a consensus, you and I would agree. Well, this is reality. I'm seeing the same crap as you, you know, immediately. It's raining here, it's raining there, there's green. It's what I call consensus reality. But contrast that with the fact that there is no true objective truth, that everything that exists only because it's observed. And that is a philosophical tree in the forest kind of perspective, but it's really important when you realize as we come into this world with the genetic programming, with the environment in utero, postnatal, developmentally, you see this every day with kids, and how the brain, the pruning takes this, almost this like, pluripotent organ that's capable of adapting to really, really, really wild ranges of existence. You know, whether we were born to do farming in China 5,000 years ago, whether we're born as a millennial and we can work on our devices by the time, we can talk, that kind of thing. The brain becomes what it's needed to become to optimize that organism's chance of survival.
Absolutely. The most efficient way of organizing to be able to survive, on this planet. And it used to be a pretty hostile place. Now it's different. There's different hostilities, but our mind will still go to fight. We talk about fight or flight. We talk about, trauma. We talk about, the ability for us to return back to places that are painful and stay there and recirculate that, strengthen those neuronal connections, strengthen those pathways, just like creating the Grand Canyon, it wasn't created in a day. We prune these neurons, we prune these networks, and we stay in these thought, feeling, behavior triangles that pull us right back to a place of pain and suffering. And a lot of people doing psychedelic work, including Stan Grof, will go back to the perinatal, right? And you talk about the experience pre-verbally, there's no language centers in the brains at that point. What's going on inside that little human's mind and their conception of reality? And you talk about, stuff like birth trauma, and the analysts will go back through this kind of stuff. Like, what was your birth? What was your birth like? Was it a 28-hour birth and you couldn't fit through the birth canal and you had shoulder dystocia, you were stuck? I mean, do these things affect us? I mean, I think they, to a person who can't talk and therefore form no memories, I think they certainly can. I mean, certainly the founding fathers of, psychoanalysis surely believed it. But going back into experiences with these medicines, people have fully, relived things that they shouldn't quite remember based on our primitive understanding of, you can't form memories until you have words.
Right. And I think that, one of the trauma models that we're adopting here often takes us to pre-verbal, sometimes in utero, memories, which are usually traumatic in nature. They seem to be the most indelible and resistant to time healing all wounds that need to be atoned, corrected, understood, processed, however you want to think of it. And that is kept at bay by all the other crap this brain is pruning away and learning to do, and then adapting and being really biologically tied to the planet. You got to eat, you got to sleep, you got to wear clothes, there are all these rules, you got to get educated, signs everywhere, there's signs kind of thing. And inadvertently, during this earth school process, if you will, the very nature of existence is obscured. It's almost like there's been wool pulled over the reality, the very nature of existence and reality over your eyes, because you can't remember. Hell, most people can't remember before 4 or 5 years old, but you can't remember who or what you were before you were even conceived. Some people do. We've talked about that on the show, but it's this necessary ingredient.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't disappear, but it certainly fades into the background, right? What the roads that are traveled are the ones that are, easily accessible, right? And so you start to tune out to past experience, to feeling good, asking a person, hey, when's the last time you really felt happy for someone who's chronically depressed? Well, I never felt happy. Well, there was a time where you did. Can we go back there? Can we think about that? I don't really know. You know what I mean? That is sort of, I think, summarizing what you're saying is that we get so far away from, you know, feeling good, feeling free, feeling, you know, true love, feeling accepted, safe, secure, bypassed experience to that we can't even remember that anymore. And that's such an important part of feeling centered and good and being what we would consider like mentally healthy, if you want to use those words.
Well, and if you start talking about this like we are, and people aren't ready to hear it, they're not willing to hear it. You're not the deliverer of that information, or it's not their time on their path, or whatever you want to think of it. I think that resistance comes from the fact that this confronts, if you think about existence, it confronts your own mortality. And there is a biologic resistance against that for most biologic creatures. So there's this weird repression, and I think an aversion to want to go there intellectually.
This has kept this person safe, right? You talk about psychological defense mechanisms, traumatic childhood. This put up a wall between me and my parents, who were hitting each other or doing drugs or ignoring my basic needs, not responding to me, telling me to shut up when I had a feeling of feeling happy or expressive. You know, they were depressed and miserable. So that was told to get the hell out of there. But you tell a person, hey, you know, I want to start to, you know, essentially peel away these things that were making you feel safe. And just for us to think about them in a collective ways, how is this serving you now? Oh, yeah. This is my stakes and spears, man. These are my walls. This is keeping me safe. It's absolutely, people walk away from that. I've walked away from it.
I think we all have. If it challenges our own, you know, life's lessons, it's something that there's that rapprochement. There's sometimes it's sought intellectually or existentially, or often it's done through life experience, through trauma, through falling in love, some sort of profound psychic shift that gets people thinking about it. But when you get to the point where you can have this conversation, you can think about this, and the very reason we're doing this podcast during this time, I think, is because this is what we've got so much wool pulled over our eyes right now. Even Mario Andretti would crash if you threw mud on the windshield. And I think that we're blinded in forgetting that, and it's important to talk about. And this is why people get into sensory deprivation, and they get into holotropic breathing, and they get into yoga, tai chi, and even social deprivation, which there's a really interesting theory of that. Basically, you have this period of development where they call it a social reward learning critical period. But it's sort of during that pruning phase when you're open and reopening this brain's ability to kind of have more feelers out there, you think of them as neuronic pathways, and they get reduced and reduced and reduced. And like you said, learn our usual paths through the forest, neuroenergetically speaking, and we stick with the familiarity and the comfort of what we know. And if that's trapping old wounds from childhood and into adulthood, we do that unconsciously.
Right. It hurts to go down this path. I don't want to do that anymore. Even though the end of this path could be, sure, this kid, you know, punched me, but then I made friends with him and he was my best friend, where I felt connected and I felt like I had, you know, someone who could be my buddy, right? I mean, I was just having a conversation like this with another therapist last night, you know, and, you know, we're so separated, right? But we can learn to separate, right? Because the social ties are so fragmented. You take back our roots evolutionarily. We're a pack animal, you know, we depended on each other and for our survival, you know? And so having these social bonds, parts of our brain evolved, or, you know, were there for our survival, not going down that path again, but you know, separating us from that creates, and I think it's from this perception of rejection, or maybe not having enough opportunities to have positive, you know, relationships that are reinforced, that are sort of appropriate, you know, feelings of, you know, desperation, feeling like you're on the outside, you know, sadness, right? I mean, there are things for everybody has a homeostatic level where they feel good with this amount of human contact. And we've lost that with how we've organized our communities, where we live, how we live, our connection with the environment is another one too. Like you were saying, this is part of who we are is, you know, eating, drinking, going down a clean river, being on the mountaintop, literally as an expression. We don't have access to those things like our ancestors did anymore.
No, and one big problem is human evolution moves very slowly. You know, what takes millions of years to occur in, let's say, computer hardware might happen in a few years. So we've got this technology outpacing our own evolution, which, you know, like you said, we evolved through packs. We did not evolve to absorb 8 billion people's problems through social media at a moment's notice, you know, at an intrusive moment's notice.
That's alerts, right.
Notifications, habitual, always have my TV on, it's on at the dentist, I got my iPhone in my pocket and my news alerts. That's not something we'll be equipped to process in a million years, but no. Machines, AI, things like that are doing it right now. It's sifting through data. The difference is, arguably, we're more than just a sum of our parts. I mean, that's the premise, I think, of this show and the consciousness and existence, and being able to value the infinite angles of awareness and experience is at the very nature of why the universe exists. To understand itself, to sample itself. You know, I can read about the experience of a slave. I can read about the experience of a woman who's, you know, been denied the right to vote or whatever the human experience was. But unless I go through it myself, I really truly can't know. Then you have a bunch of people going through the same experience and they all have different experiences. Why do some people in the same foxhole get PTSD and the other guy doesn't? So that's kind of where I think the application of psychedelics and medicine becomes very, very handy, because it's opening back up this functional, important reducing valve.
Neuroplasticity, this window of, like we used to call it, this window of critical, you know, brain development, which there are certain things that are absolutely critical, but there is so much more plasticity in the brain that's been uncovered in the last 30 years, you know, since we were basically in university. And psychedelics can enable so much of that to go through, relive an experience in a supportive way. You know, I'm thinking about MDMA now with PTSD specifically, and have a corrective emotional experience, right? Have someone sit with you who can bond with you, and you can bond with them if you're the person who's had this traumatic experience and you have pushed yourself away because you don't feel connected anymore, which I think is a common paradigm. People don't understand me. I don't feel connected to them. I haven't experienced PTSD myself, and so I don't want to offend anyone if that's not their experience, but that's the way, from my head, I have perceived some people to have experienced things. But to be able to reconnect with the person, and that's opening up parts of the brain that, you know, have been closed off, or we didn't think maybe would work anymore at a certain stage. Like, that's just sort of a biological clock that turns off. Well, that's not necessarily the case. You know, there are groups looking at this, you know, looking at the neurotrophic factors and reigniting pathways, healthy pathways, right? And reliving healthy pathways and reliving experiences in a healthy way, and a way of reframing what has happened, in my perspective, to a more, realistic or gentle interpretation of the events and an accepting of the events. Cause some of the stuff that happens to people in trauma, it just, there's no saying that was a good experience because it absolutely was horrible. But looking at it from a different perspective and different lens isn't something we can do when we're locked inside these pathways that have been, you know, evolutionarily driven and pushed towards, but we can open that back up again. I mean, that's just,
Well, that's probably one of the leading theories of the why or the how, I guess, that psychedelics do anything in terms of having healing potential. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the social reward learning critical period. And you can do this through social deprivation. Social deprivation has shown that reactivation, kind of that critical learning period, just like, and I always picture a forest, you know, and all these different trails that lead to different places and different outcomes. And one day you might, the weather might send you in this direction. The other day, you know, your desire for resources might send you in this direction. And another day you might just be enjoying the billabong or whatever. But one day you're going to realize like, oh, wow, there's an old pathway there. I used to take that all the time as a kid because there was a really cool rock over there. I forgot it was there. And then you start mm-hmm. spending more and more time there. And then the main road you take every day, I got to make the donuts to work or whatever, has less importance. Right. So I think what psychedelics are doing is they're mechanically interfering with our meta programming, right?
Right. This is the idea of the default mode network coming offline. Default mode network is exactly what keeps you on your road to the donut shop, protecting you. I'm going to pay attention to the stimulus coming this way. This guy's turning left. There's a kid crossing over here. You get the right space. You know, we'll talk about set and setting, I think, at some point. Maybe we could just talk a little bit about it now. But, they're in the right place, in the right time, with the right support, right? That's now we're talking more about the setting, right? Who you're doing it with, the level of training or level of experience this person has in altered states of consciousness, right? The safety of the environment, how you're feeling the night before, you know, what's going on there, how you're doing, how you're checking in mentally is more of the set side of things. But both things, when you square them up, can lead you to opening up, decoupling that default mode network, shining a light on all those paths, right? And walking down them, they might be amazing. Walking down some of them might be difficult, but they're always there. And I think this is what I hear about psychedelic experiences for a reason, you know. The your unconscious is bringing something to the surface for a reason, like and looking at that from a new lens can lead to catharsis, can lead to healing, can lead to reprocessing, re-experiencing, and sometimes dramatic shifts, not all the time, but sometimes dramatic shifts in your feeling states after, your way of being in the world and interpreting relationships and, you know, uncoupling unhealthy relationships. They talk about this in the MAPS course and completed, but don't get a divorce right if you've had a high dose phase 3 clinical trial MDMA session, because, you know, even though you may be onto some sort of nugget of truth, something you've rediscovered about yourself, that the fact that this relationship, for example, is not healthy, you really got to integrate it. You really got to soak it in. You really got to, you know, sit with it. The door has been opened. The light has been shined on the path, but that is just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the start and the integration piece through reflection and in our framework and Western framework through what we call integration therapy is critical to these medicines working correctly. So not just the set and setting, not just the actual experience or the key or the catalyst or whatever we want to call it, but the reprocessing of material that comes up.
Well, and there's a little bit of, I call an autoscopic view, and to what we were talking about, like with the metaphor in the forest with the pads, that would generally work if you're talking only about neuroplasticity. But something weird happens when you interfere with the mm-hmm. brain's higher order functioning so profoundly, like through a psychedelic, that it disrupts so many of those trails. It sometimes hides them. You know, you may not know what your name is. You may literally forget your name. Mm-hmm. This total state of ego dissolution, we're talking about ketamine, some people call it a K-hole, but you get to
ego death
where mm-hmm. the brain or your experience through your brain is so reduced that you float above the forest, mm-hmm. because there's an observer that's within our biology that mm-hmm. we're chasing around our whole life, searching for the scent of ourselves. And it most likely is integrated through the pineal gland. You know, we'll get into DMT in a little bit, but mm-hmm. It's changing the knob on the transceiver a little bit mm-hmm. to, like you said, have that distance to revisit a trauma in a more of a detached way that you can slow it down, process, integrate. And by, like you said, absolutely don't get a divorce, but you know, they're doing some of these therapies on cops and soldiers. Don't send these guys straight back into war. They need time to process, integrate, reflect. It kind of takes mm-hmm. them back to more of a childlike state, which again is closer to our source in the first place. But you've got setting is critical because it controls variables either during the shutdown process mm-hmm. or through the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. It's a controlled environment. It removes creating kind of new pathways, like, oh, there's this fire alarm being pulled while I'm in this deep, you know, I'm in this shrink's office getting my ketamine experience. That would be very disruptive. And so I think psychedelics, I mean, Nixon really got all fired up about this and everyone since then, not because of, you know, some people say they're afraid that people are going to wake up. I don't think that was their intent. I think they were afraid of what they didn't know. And they were lumping drugs, anything that alters the mind, as sort of against God or against their religion or politics mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. civilized society, whoever you want to think it. But the interesting thing is, and this is something we talked about before the show, the critical message, and if anybody's still awake, that the chemical does not provide that experience itself. It could, we can talk about that, but let's just say the chemical mm-hmm. enters and disrupts a neural network to allow a different perspective. What I was saying, the infinite angles and awareness of an experience. Mm-hmm. It's so a lot of, you know, cultures have viewed these sacraments as containing ancient wisdom, as if the molecule itself connects you to that collective unconscious or the Akashic records of all the mm-hmm. memories, experiences, feelings, insights, whatever, of all the people who took it before you.
That's right. I mean, reliving past lives. These are experiences that have been recorded for, you know, millennia, reliving past lives, you know, understand being in a different place and time in a different body, you know, being, like you said, completely outside of your body, or part of, all of life or all of energy being outside of the corporeal or physical realm, being more of an energetic realm. But it's fascinating that, you know, two completely disconnected, you know, physically and knowledge-based peoples can have, you know, an extremely similar experience. That is to me very revealing about, you know, what this experience is all about. It's beyond, you know, it goes deeply into the mystical.
Well, and I'm certainly not saying that, you know, entheogens, psychedelics, however you want to think about it, are great for everybody. I think of the Matrix a lot. Not everyone's ready to be unplugged. It's a profound psychic shift. It's hard to plan even with the best intentions. You know, one of my partners mm-hmm. who founded this company would do 7 weeks of therapy before 7 hours, seven discrete sessions of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, and then 7 hours of integration, you know, post-treatment. So you're talking 21 weeks there. That's almost half a year. Mm-hmm. But part of that preparation included things like looking at psychopathologies, looking at diet, substances, chemicals, maladaptive coping, getting to relationships.
That's what I was going to say. Getting to know how a person copes, getting to know their, you know, how they've dealt with struggles in the past, what works for them, building a relationship with someone. And the MAP studies, right? All the people have had severe treatment refractory PTSD in those studies, but they all have had tons of therapy, you know? So you're looking at a group of people, and we're talking about who's an appropriate candidate for these medicines. You know, we're looking at a group of people who A, have been ruled out for having, you know, a psychotic illness or a first degree relative with a psychotic illness, something like bipolar, schizophrenia, and also people who've had typically years of psychotherapy, have been on multiple medications, who maintain a typically a therapist outside of this, the study group, which involves, you know, I think it's 3 90-minute sessions, you know, to get to know a person, and before you have your first experience, and then you have, you know, 90-minute integration sessions after that, and they're spacing things out. I mean, that's another thing we don't have time to talk about is the practicality of applying this. First of all, you know, we do need to educate the public better that, you know, taking these medicines with the hope that you're going to get the result that they've published in MAPS or that we're talking about, where you have these amazing experiences that are integrating you and grounding you, making you feel more in touch with, you know, your true nature. That does not happen by mistake, particularly with cultures that have an integrated network of, you know, they have healers that go through, or shamans that go through years of tutelage, maybe their whole lives, and are selected by, you know, people for specific qualities, right? And have, you know, close family ties that were networked together, that they knew what was going on. They knew people were using these medicines and why, and there was a purpose. And so the community, I think, is something that I really thought about when we think about integrating these medicines into our practice. Is what is your social network like? How can we support you? How can you be supported therapeutically? Because certainly you can be re-traumatized by any of the drugs we've talked about so far.
Right.
By going into a horrific experience, what we used to call a bad trip, which under the right support may be the curative useful process.
Right.
It may need to be what needs to be explored and come out in the right set and setting.
So that's what I mean by set and setting, not like, where are you and who are you with when you take your drug? That's again, like you said, the tip of the iceberg. It's all the events leading up to that, because it is such a potentially profoundly shifting thing. You know, to your point before, it made me think of, we had Dr. Bruce Grayson on the show, and he was the scientist that really was credited with actually defining clinically what qualifies or constitutes as a near-death experience. And that's one of the things that I researched at the University of Virginia with him, is if near-death experiences are so great and everybody feels love, which we can talk about in a second, I find it interesting that love, mm-hmm. altruism, gratitude, some of the highest vibrating frequency emotions, if you think of them in terms of energy and vibration, yeah. tend to be what's below the surface. So I wanted, you know, at that point in my career, I was concerned about what people thought of me, whether they thought I was kooky or not. I gave up on that a long time ago, but I thought, why don't I design a devil's advocate experiment, and let's go look at people who've had near-death experiences and find out something bad about them. And, you know, a shocking thing came out of the data. You were 8 times more likely to get divorced. And that's what made me think of it before, when you said, hey, don't go divorcing if you have a profound psychedelic experience, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because there's such a radical shift in terms of the evolution of your psychology, at least, although I think this is deeper encoded, that it shouldn't be gone into lightly. It shouldn't be gone into without a professional, whether that's someone with a beard like us, or a shaman, like you said, whose family has been doing this for hundreds of generations, for all we know. Set and setting is absolutely critical, because even if you control as many variables as you can, if you get every mm-hmm. 10 people prepared and you tried to control for it, and you gave 10 people the same drug and the same dose and the same route of administration, the same environment with the same providers, you're going to have 10 different experiences. And that's what makes it kind of unique and powerful mm-hmm. to that person's path and their own spiritual development. Mm-hmm. And curiosity is another thing that goes along with the gratitude and some of these more positive things. So I'm making a comparison between psychedelics and near-death experiences, but if it's so great, how come not always great things come out? And then how do you define what's good or bad? Like you were talking about trauma and these horrible things that they go through. Well, if it gives them the equipment to be a more altruistic, compassionate, present, self-aware healer for people that goes through it, was it really bad? You know, that person right. might not qualify it as bad at a different point in their life.
Right. Yeah, it's the valence that you put on it. And it's, you know, you talk about the observer and the observer being able to objectively see, start to see these things rather than being, you know, over, you know, just overly excited in a fight or flight and just, you know, going away from it. And amygdala's firing. We're pushing away from these experiences. If these experiences can be seen and held, and you can sit with it, you can breathe through, you can feel it, you know, that takes effort, you know, that takes support, because those are, like, again, even doing it in a setting where, you know, MDMA is on board, is difficult, you know, and not everyone gets better, right? I mean, the trials show, you know, about 60% of people don't meet criteria for PTSD after they've been through the study, which is, again, like I said, you know, real world, that's a whole nother discussion. Could you implement this? I think it's insane to be able to do that, to have a clinic that's organized in the way that MAPS has organized this. Tons of money, tons of time. People cannot afford it. You know, but even after this super high intensity outcome with very well trained, you know, therapists who have been through specific, you know, psychological training, specific training on MDMA, 60%, right? I mean, that's an amazing number. We can't get anywhere close to that with the drugs that we have currently in our armamentarium. So, you know, there is still, I think, a misconception that, oh, wow, if I have this experience, I'm going to be cured. I mean, it's not as simple.
Well, or the bigger misconception is, if I take this chemical,
right,
it will give me this outcome or this experience. And I see that with any drug, right? Prozac.
Oh, yeah.
Let's pick on Prozac. If I take this happy pill, it will make me happy. Yeah. And then people find out that's not always the case. Matter of fact, more often than not, it is the case. So I guess in the similar spirit, let's talk about this little baby. This is a toughie. I like this picture. It reminds me of Pink Floyd, The Wall, and a lot of the great artistry and going into the flower. But this is a real nasty sucker called henbane. It's a member of the nightshade family. Most of these, whether they contain, you know, alkaloids like scopolamine, atropine, and stuff like that. So you can disrupt neural processing through anticholinergic methods, through anti-MDMA, through serotonergic agonism. Doesn't really matter as much how you disrupt the network. The key is, when the network's disruptive, you reveal kind of what's underneath, or like you said, some of these more minor pathways. But the interesting thing about this, Vikings used to make a brew out of this before they went into battle. Matter of fact, a lot of people called the berserkers, thought was to be because of their ingestion of either henbane, mandrake, which I was going to put a picture on, which some people have claimed, even around the time of Jesus, that he was poisoned with mandrake and all of that. But that creates this anticholinergic delirium, similar to the Amanita, the flag Eric, the first picture. That's a real ancient historical one.
Yeah, and the other one was the mold growing on the rye, the ergotamines, and that's the derivative of, you know, chemical derivative of LSD. But I think the Greek, this one's evading me. The Greek substance in the Greek ritual, they think had to do with a similar sort of mold and an ergotamine type compound. No one's been able to definitively say, but.
Yeah, some sort of, well, morning glory seeds, lysergic acid, amides, they're all kind of LSA derivatives binding similar parts of the brain. Ibogaine, you know, talking of, actually, there's another chemical I worked on with Dr. Deborah Mash at the University of Miami. Very, very fascinating. So Nixon, Reagan, the anti-drug movement, it was because these things were always bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, ibogaine not only is not addictive, it has actually been proven and reproven to be anti-addictive, which kind of goes in the whole face of, like, well, any drug that alters your chemistry is, you know, bad or whatever. Ibogaine's very fascinating, although it's not unique. There are plenty. I think the experience is ultimately what releases, but how Ibogaine deconstructs consciousness must touch on and or relieve trauma that ultimately was a necessary precursor to the epigenetic development of addiction, of the phenomenon of addiction. So Ibogaine is thought to interrupt this, much like, you know, I published a paper with Krupitsky in Russia on ketamine and it's how it helps alcoholics. Now Ibogaine is used for heroin addicts. It definitely shows as a chemical more than methadone, suboxone, naloxone, all the crap we use today. By far and away, this had more beneficial results in terms of sustained abstinence. Mm-hmm. And these people were also kind of getting this emotional shifting process and this psychic change. It shows
the classical psychedelics, right? And Ibogaine is a chemical or compound that affects mu opioid receptors too, if memory serves. Is that correct, Mark?
Yeah.
Which is a totally different piece to the classic, what we're calling classical psychedelics, mescaline, LSD, psilocybin. You know, that piece, you know, is involved with addiction in a more, you know, reproducible way, I guess you could say. The opioid pathways.
Everything we've talked about so far has been organic. It's been things that have directly come from the earth, a plant sacrament, a cactus, a fungus, however you want to think of it. I like MDMA because it doesn't nicely fit into any of these boxes. It's synthetic. Mm-hmm. It's both an amphetamine. So rather than shutting down parts of the brain, quite honestly, it's activating some of the most ancient primitive parts of the brain. Maybe it's an important part of the experience. Maybe it's an interference. I don't totally know, but it's not. So it's basically addictive because of its amphetamine side, less so than some others. It's got a stimulant property, which interferes with this, with the process. It's got hallucinogenic process. So there's like other synthetics. Yeah, there's these visuals and fractals and a lot of people like that part of it. But to me, that's just more of a curious observation of the phenomenon of your brain shutting down programs while you're, quote, awake. When you're asleep, a lot of these programs naturally dripped off and they're hardwired into the reticular activating system. So this freak of nature is not only a stimulant, it's not only psychedelic hallucinogenic, it's very entheogenic. It's one of the most entheogenic, I think, in terms of people having this overwhelming and very reproducible connection, almost like the world's most strong oxytocin surge, you know, and that bond between a mother and a daughter. But you might do that with a stranger, you might do that with your spouse, you might do that with your provider, you might do
with
that
your therapist,
with a plant in the room, quite honestly.
And there's clinical trials going on right now with MDMA through with MAPS support for you know, adults with autism, right? So you talked about oxytocin, you talked about that pathway being sort of you know, disrupted. It's fascinating to think, could you reactivate that in people who, you know, and provide them that connectedness, provide them some help and healing in that way through reopening those pathways, right, in a non-traumatic way?
Yeah, and I put the chemical structures because I thought we'd get into that a little bit, but I changed my mind. But they interestingly all have benzene, central benzene arenes, really strong electron withdrawing groups like this oxygen here, triple bond to nitrogen, some of the other ones. But they mimic neurotransmitters and or they interfere with neurotransmitter, which is kind of the point of, like you said, the key to opening up that lock, which is the brain's normal operating state programs that are running, ego that's hardwired. There's another synthetic. Now, this one gives me the heebie-jeebies because of the providers, mostly anesthesiologists, that are out there banging this, you know, chemical that's very closely related to this little guy here, which we'll talk about in a second. That's also, Park Davis invented this to replace PCP because it had some unwanted side effects as an anesthetic. It was safe in the battlefield. It was great for elderly burn people. It made them less crazy than PCP.
hemodynamically people stay stable, right? You don't have rapid drops in blood pressure.
Yeah, it's
racing heart rates,
cardiovascular support. Mm-hmm. So this is the very fallacy we're talking of, is that I can go to some doc in a box shop who's just gonna, hi, what's your name? Take your money. Let me give you a chemical. I don't want to call it anything. It's not a street drug. It's not a wise ancient plant chemical. But the experience and the deconstruction is very, very profound, very, very real. And you've got someone that's very, very uninterested in your experience and really annoyed if you talk to them about meeting the supreme deity or seeing dead loved ones or some transcendental moment of awareness.
It's completely divorced from all of the psychological underpinnings that are essential that we know and understand are essential to healing. But I still do think, even in this case, I'm going to take exception with you, there is a role. There is a role for it because, you know, and I've seen this a couple times, acutely suicidal people, I've not been able to help. I've had them on every drug you can imagine, antipsychotics for the antidepressive qualities, mood stabilizers for their antidepressive qualities, antidepressants. And then, you know, I've actually taken people off the drugs, the common psychiatric drugs, and treated them with IV ketamine, had them treated. I don't provide that treatment at this point. And that just like a veil, and especially in a few days, disappear. So I think in an emergency setting, an infusion in a non-psychotherapeutic setting can actually do something, but then you have to immediately get in there with support. But this could, you know, I just read an article about, you know, a physician, a psychiatrist in India who was using this stuff to keep people out of the hospital. They just don't have enough places to put people with the population and the amount of hospitals they have there. Interestingly enough, we have a very similar situation in this country, particularly for adolescents, but even for adults too, is, you know, I just had an adult that got hospitalized here in Tampa, 2 hours away from their family. I mean, how's that therapeutic or supportive, right? So if you do have an severely acutely suicidal adult, I think using ketamine just as an infusion could have a role.
I definitely think it has a role. In that regard, it's analogous to a chemical ECT. So the same reason the ECT shuts down these active, entrained, suicidal program, intrusive thoughts, ECT disrupts that. I think ketamine does that as well. That's basic top level shutting down of the consciousness. One thing that's common about all of these, they're aryl cyclohexamine, the double benzene type of deal, the PCP, dextromethorphan, ketamine, MK-801 is a research one that's used a lot to study damage to the NMDA system. Well, the vast majority of our cells are use glutamate as a neurotransmitter. So we talked about disrupting consciousness or the doors of perception, let's say the consensus reality that my biology assembles that loosely approximates your own. It reveals that these chemicals are at the very, very kind of core, the level of experience, and they can continue to take you back and down and kind of like layers of the onion. Ketamine's just scratching the surface when it's used for the acutely suicidal patient.
Right.
We did a ton of research on route of administration, IV, IM, intranasal, profoundly different experiences, even across large populations of people. But at the end of the day, if you facilitate a mind-revealing experience, you have a responsibility, this duty to protect and integrate. I mean, it's the very, Hippocratic oath, really, first do no harm. If I'm
right.
I'm like a bad trauma therapist that just poured salt in someone's wound and kicked them out.
Yeah, you just took the demon out of the cage and now they're terrorizing this person, right? Whereas they could have an experience, a corrective experience of this demon is a part of me, but this demon doesn't own me. It doesn't control me. You know, it doesn't have to scare me and make me run away and put it back in the cage. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, using a substance on its own or using it just in an infusion setting, I mean, I think is a terrible paradigm. And I think we both agree on that.
Yeah. And, you
there
know,
goes my dog.
Oh, I want to be respectful of your time here. We're wrapping up here in a second, but Dextromethorphan is another one. This is one that kids abuse a lot. I think that, you know, there's an interest, there's an abuse potential, there's a sacrament, a healing component. It's just like any tool. Depends whose hand it's in, and it depends their intent, and it depends on what they're using it on. So
that's right.
Dextromethorphan is kind of a nastier one. I think ketamine sort of hit the sweet spot in terms of the armamentarium of these NMDA antagonists and the way they deconstruct consciousness. But it, you know, this one causes Olney's lesions, which are these little microvascular kind of brain damage type of thing at high doses. Whereas PCP, a lot of people were arguably doing things in a unaware state, serious things, kind of like Oscar Pistorius shooting his girlfriend, you know, people charging the police and ultimately that's why ketamine was invented to replace that, because of the problematic of what they called emergence phenomenon, which is ironically what we're seeing as a therapeutic potential.
That's funny.
is this your problem child? I believe this is another synthetic. This one's fascinating because unlike ways to deconstruct consciousness, glutamate's the workhorse, and you know the NMDA is something that psychiatry knows the least about, although interestingly it seems to be the most efficacious in disruption of consciousness. But whether you interrupt it through the serotonergic stuff, like we're looking at LSD-25 here, or you're doing an anticholinergic delirium blockade, you mentioned opioid receptors themselves can destruct, you know, put people in this like kind of hypnagogic state.
Mm-hmm.
So they certainly interrupt consciousness. The peculiar thing about this little bird is it's able to do it at doses that are on an order of magnitude far, far, far lower than anyone can explain. And there's really a lot of interesting theories about this, but we don't think serotonin is
right.
That important for consciousness. It's kind of a minor neurotransmitter. We talk about it a lot, we make a big deal, but its role in the brain is really quite small relative to other neurotransmitters. And then you take a chemical that stimulates it at millionths of a gram, and yet you get this huge psychedelic experience. That's a bit of a mystery. I think that helps clue in the fact that we don't really understand how consensus reality is put together if we can't deconstruct it.
That's right. That's right.
And here's some you know, functional MRI or PET probably of a brain's activity, probably oxygen or glucose uptake here, both on and off LSD. And it's interesting, we're talking about the brain shutting down. LSD showing activation of pretty much the whole brain, all different lobes of the brain.
And interconnectedness between areas also that weren't connecting normally.
And that's where you get synesthesia and some of the other phenomenon we've talked
right.
about.
Seeing music, tasting
sounds,
colors and sounds, color. Yeah.
You got time to talk about this one?
I got a jam, but
right.
this is an interesting
one. We're
going to
bookmark
one.
This.
Let's bookmark
this,
it.
This, we could do a whole show on this one here because unlike the plants or the synthetics, this is an endogenous one that is in our brains right now. So that's a whole show right there.
Great topic, Mark. I mean, I had a great time, man. This was great. I love always love talking to you, and you know, this is just we're scratching the surface here, and I'd love to do more time.
Let's do it again. We can talk next time about DMT and its evolutionary role, and we can talk about trauma, narrowing perspectives, and this fallacy of you and I being separate. And the us versus them and what it's going to take. We'll make a part two to this to bring healing to our civilization, to our culture, to our community, to ourselves, because it's going to start individually with each other. So Dr. Sean Paul,
Dr. Mark
so
Sylvester
in here. I have a website. You have a website. Yours is nowpsych.com. It's in the link below. Make sure you stumble on the like, subscribe on the way by to check out the Dr. Paul's Board of Affairs.
My pleasure. It was wonderful.
I tricked you. This isn't a consensus reality because you and I are in computers right now. So we're agreeing on a new consensus reality that's within another consensus reality. I'll leave you with this. Once we turn this off, is the reality that we're living in a computer program of another source? Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Join us next time.